Welcome back to another episode of Sci-Fi on Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo. And today on this episode, we're going to be talking about Christopher Nolan's sci-fi epic, Interstellar. A little bit of background on Interstellar. Interstellar was conceived by film producer Linda Obst and theoretical physicist Kip Thorne. And they had collaborated on the 1997 film Jodie Foster starrer Contact, which was a Carl Sagan novel. And the idea came about between them and a discussion about Thorne's theoretical physics work and about, you know, black holes and exotic matter and so on and so forth and wormholes. Initially, Spielberg was attached to direct. In March of 2007, Jonathan Nolan, Chris Nolan's brother, was hired to write a screenplay for the film, and at that point it got its title, Interstellar. Then there were some business moves made where Spielberg moved DreamWorks from Paramount, being the parent company, to Walt Disney. I think Interstellar was a Paramount product, Paramount title, was a Paramount intellectual property, so when he moved, he was kind of, I guess, removed himself from contention. So Jonathan Nolan, being attached still, recommended his brother, who was finished with the Batman trilogy. Christopher Nolan came on board in 2012 as the director. Chris rewrote Jonah Nolan's script when he got on board, changing a lot of it, especially the last third. Thus, they were on board. We have, as another, Wally Pfister, Nolan's longtime cinematographer, is not on board this film. He made a film called Transcendence, so he had a new cinematographer on board. He did have Hans Zimmer, again, his usual folks on board. Let's jump right into the film, shall we? We get some cold open, as it were, no real credits. So the opening production graphics, it's funny, when it starts, kind of like The Matrix did when the Warner Brothers logo was green, Nolan does here, and the Paramount colors and the colors of all the, you know, production companies when they show their logos before a film starts, they're all very brown. And we start out with Ellen Burstyn in this kind of documentary style shot talking about who we'll come to know as Cooper, the lead character. And then we cut to Matthew McConaughey in what looks like an out-of-control spacecraft. It looks like he's in a bit of an accident or he's having problems. Just before anything happens, though, he wakes up. He's home in his bed and he's been dreaming. When he wakes, his daughter, Murph, is standing next to his bed. I think she's like 10 or so-ish. And she says to him, "I thought you were a ghost," foreshadowing the ghost plot line and theme it's going to come about in this film. Straight away, one thing I noticed is the actress playing Murph at this age is not a good actress. I'd hate to judge children, right? But she has a very stagey delivery. She's not very convincing in any of her scenes. And another problem is that initially, and what starts with this scene, is that the characters in these early part of the film lob these softball lines at Cooper in order that Coop can turn around and deliver like these devastating indictments of society or these pithy lines about science or about truth and so on and so forth. So to me, straight away, it came across as very on the nose, very talky, kind of stagey dialogue. It was odd that this quickly in a film, especially a Nolan film, I'd be taken out of it by the dialogue and this young girl's performance. But I definitely was. She goes back to bed, and Coop turns towards the window to look out at his farm, and we hear an organ music cue, not unlike the end of Thus Big Zarathustra from 2001, cueing us in as to, you know, where this film's thematic parentage lies. Now, we continue with the documentary-style shots of people talking about a Dust Bowl, and we hear talk also about the blight, and that most of the cereal crops and most crops in the world have been afflicted by the blight, and the only crop left is corn that can grow. Every other crop is incapable of growing and producing food. And we get descriptions of a new Dust Bowl. And what's interesting here is Nolan used footage from a Ken Burns documentary on the Dust Bowl, which Burns did in 2012. They were so impressed by it that they asked Burns permission to use the footage, which Burns readily gave. So they intercut actors talking specifics about sort of the future Dust Bowl in with Ken Burns actors talking about the real Dust Bowl. We're also introduced in this scene to John Lithgow as Coop's father. And this is very cool and clever. In the opening scenes with his family, we're hearing the descriptions of what the families had to do in the Dust Bowl, and that they had to turn plates upside down, and they had to cover glasses when they were put out. And we watched the family set up for dinner do these preparations. And very clever of Nolan to do. Again, with the opening scenes in this family, McConaughey seems like he's in another movie. All of the family are given very, very stagey softball lines that he is able to turn around and deliver these devastating, pithy, you know, zingers and one lines. And you know, he is this sort of engineer, farmer, sage, pilot, you know, scientist, you name it. McConaughey is the embodiment of, I don't know, rational man in this film. Every time someone says anything to him, he comes back with this, you know, pithy, deep, truthful statement. And it quickly gets old. It doesn't come across as authentic. It comes across as very preachy. I don't buy it for a minute, even though I'm immediately impressed with McConaughey's gravity as an actor, as I always am. I'm not buying the character of Coop as anything but a mouthpiece for the script. So they leave for school. On the way, there's a tire blown out. Murph is made fun of by her brother, Murphy's Law, and she's angry with her father. Why did you name me after a law that, you know, things go wrong? And her father says it's not about what goes wrong. It's about anything that can happen, will happen, and your mother and I like that just fine, and so on and so forth. So we haven't seen any hint of a mother. We'll find out about the mother's fate fairly soon. And then in this moment while they're fixing the tire, a drone goes by overhead. Very cool. All of a sudden, and we're not sure why, Coop puts his family in the truck, takes off, and gives chase to the drone. And what we see is Coop pulls out his laptop, and what he's trying to do is hack the drone and get it to land because the solar cells are worth lots of money. And actually, he could put them in a harvester, or he could put them in a place where, you know, they could power his entire farm. So this is a cool little scene where they're chasing the drone through all this corn, and, you know, it's very dramatic. You know, they get to the edge of a cliff, and the truck can't go any further, and they don't think they have the drone. And of course, Coop has captured it, and they bring it to rest. We're not sure why it was even down there, but we are given a clue. They do address this in the film, that there must be some kind of signal that drew the drone down. Otherwise, it would have been, you know, continued to circle and high overhead as a surveillance drone that it was. And they'll ram this home in a scene that's coming up fairly soon with something happening, some kind of anomaly happening on the Cooper farm. Coop has to attend a parent-teacher conference to talk about the future of his children. We find out that his son Tom's test scores are not good enough to allow him to go to college, so that he must become a farmer. Cooper is outraged at it. He gets a very lucid, you know, delivery from the people at the school that, look, you know, we need farmers more than we need anything else. And we hear that universities are having trouble getting money. So it's, you know, very rare for anyone to be educated in anything anymore. Most folks are taught the engineering and biology of farming and sent to work to produce food, which the earth is, what we're told, running out of fairly quickly. And there's one scene in here, again, there's lines given to Cooper that allow him to become outraged. It turns out that Murph had gotten into a fight at school because someone had said that the moon landings had never happened. And we hear from the teachers that, you know, the new textbooks that have been delivered are been corrected, and that the moon landings were faked to bankrupt the Soviet Union. And of course, you know, Coop's with the audience, and that you don't think we landed on the moon. And then Coop gets to go into a whole outrage thing about what's happened to science, what's happened to this, and he gets to be self-righteous. And I'm already tired of his character reacting to non-character mouthpieces in order that Coop can be, you know, I don't know, he's too perfect. He's too perfect of a character, and he's everything and everyone. He's like a kind of a, you know, it more belongs in like a 1950s sci-fi film. That makes me think of War of the Worlds, you know, Clayton, the super scientist. He's a nuclear scientist. He can pilot airplanes, and he's very smart, and he's charming and all this stuff. And it's kind of a throwback, but in a very clumsy way that myself, I don't find that it works. So when they return home, we see that all the combines on the farm have gone haywire and have come to circle the Cooper farmhouse, which is kind of a cool scene. Cooper mentions to his father that he had to reprogram them all and that there's some kind of anomaly in the area, some kind of magnetic anomaly that that drove the combines wild. And obviously they're setting up, you know, what's going to happen later in this film with this information, which is kind of cool. So Murph tells her father that there's a ghost in the library and drags him up to look at the books that have fallen on the library floor. Of course, you know, our stalwart scientist looks at the books and said, it's not a ghost, Murph. And she says, no, it must be because the books – and Murph intuits that the books have fallen in a patterned way to communicate in Morse code and dots and dashes. And the filmmaker doesn't show us this, in fact. We're told it by Murph, but as an audience, all we see is strewn books on the floor, and it seems like an extremely unlikely leap of logic that a child of Murph's age would make, that books falling in a library are done in a way that makes Morse code. So, you know, Nolan needs it for his story, so we can begin to look at the library as a place of communication, but it seems extremely unlikely in the film, very much so. That, again, I've in the first 30 minutes, 35 minutes of this film, I'm about as far away from a Nolan film as I can possibly be. I don't believe in much of anything that's going on here, except I'm really being manipulated into taking in information that will be used later to manipulate me yet further. We have a scene now with Cooper and his father sitting on the front porch in the evening, and we hear his father saying, Coop, you were either born 40 years too late or 40 years too early. You don't belong here, right? Setting up a line that that Coop belongs in space. And we get this line, you know, we used to look at the stars. Now we only look down at the dirt. And we get lines from Lithgow about how, you know, it used to be so great. They used to invent a new gadget, you know, every day back in the, and that's, you know, his reminiscences are supposed to be back where we are now. And, you know, they're looking back fondly on our incredible age of consumption as this golden age of science and reason. And it just seems very hollow, frankly. They go to a ball game in the neighborhood, and we gather that is not a professional game. It's in a very small stadium with seemingly local players putting on uniforms of the Yankees. And Coop's father's making fun of it. In the middle of the game, we see a giant dust storm in the distance, and as we see the town react, this is nothing new. So we get this little bit of conflict, and dust storm gets pretty bad. They're driving home in it, and it's pretty cool, actually. They put on masks and goggles, and the storm is shot really well. The sound of the storm is great, and everything, you know, the wind blowing the gritty dust into the car and into the house. Very cool. Good Foley work. Really puts you right in the storm. It was very effective. At one point, Murph and Coop go up to the library, because they left a window open there and the dust has blown all throughout the library. And when they shut the window, they see the dust forming on the floor and it looks like barcode lines. Somehow Coop is fascinated by this and he sleeps in the library. And in the morning when Murph wakes him up, he makes this intuit it's some odd form of gravitic anomaly and he throws a coin and it sticks on one of the bars. He says this is binary code. Thick lines are zero, thin lines are one, or vice versa. And so Coop translates the message, and what he discovers is that it's coordinates that are not far from the Cooper homestead, and he pinpoints it on a local map. It's during the day. No one else is around but Coop and Murph, and he tells Murph she has to stay in the house. He's going to go find these coordinates, and it's too dangerous, and so on and so forth. And we all know in the audience that she's going to stow away in the truck, all of us except Cooper, however. And of course, there is a moment when she, you know, reveals herself in the truck and he's miffed but smiling, you know, because he loves his daughter. He can't say no. And so they go together. And seemingly after a day of driving, it's now evening, they reach some chain link fence. The lights blare and we see a brief little sign taped on a chain link fence that says NORAD. So we gather we're in, you know, some sort of old military bunker at some point. And they're both taken prisoner. And we cut immediately to a room where Cooper's being interrogated by an AI named TARS. Now, I want to talk a little bit about these AIs. They're very cool. The design of the artificial intelligence robots in this film are really wonderful. There are a series of sort of, you know, rectangular shapes that are connected to each other. And enables the robot to walk and pivot and move in wonderful different ways. It's a very brilliant design. Just very unexpected, you know, the interlocking steel that pivots in different places. And it's really cool. Before anyone comes in, we hear Coop's angry tirade that these robots were developed by the military and were initially all Marines, all originally military robots. And of course, he's against them all and he thinks they were all, you know, they're all, you have to be careful. You never know when they're going to turn on you. And he's angry. And then enter Anne Hathaway as young Dr. Brand. She takes him to a conference room where he's reunited with Murph. We see a bunch of people sitting around the room. Actually, it looks like kind of a 70s conference room, frankly. Sir Michael Caine is in there as Brand's father. And we see William Devane, who plays the head of NASA, which is in a casting coup. I love William Devane. We see these astronauts' photos on the wall. We see something called Project Lazarus. They sit down, and Coop knows Brand's father from back in the day. And what they've stumbled upon is NASA. Once they find that out, they can relax a little bit. And so now we get a big info dump about what's going on. And the blight is about to make the jump to the corn crops. What we get is Brand Sr.'s dire warnings that Murphy's generation will be the Earth's last, as the blight will consume, it feeds on nitrogen, which is in 80% of the atmosphere, and there'll be less and less oxygen put back in as plants and trees die. So not only will there be no more food, but the blight will steal the air from human beings, and we will starve and suffocate. So what we find out in our big turn is that there's been gravitic anomalies detected near the planet in the past 50 years. One of these gravitic anomalies is what sent Coop's spacecraft down, and there were other ones that they detected. And then the largest one was detected in the orbit of Saturn, and it turned out to be opening of a wormhole, which is very cool. NASA has sent craft through the wormhole to investigate new planets for the human race to migrate to as the Earth can no longer sustain them. What we find out is that they found a system with three habitable worlds, and they need another mission is going to go and investigate the claims of the three astronauts. Basically, each astronaut in one of these missions went to a world by themselves. They checked it out. If it was suitable for life, they sent back a thumbs up. If it wasn't, it was a one-way trip, and they, you know, they spent their last days in their habitat alone on these planets. Pretty cool, actually. Part of me wish they would have played this up a little more, because it's a wonderful, stark, what an incredibly intense and lonely notion of these incredible heroes and what they did. But not to be. It's not our story. Our story is that in a system of three planets with three of these 12, you know, there is a very good chance of a habitable world for humanity. Then Coop says, well, what does that matter? What, you know, it doesn't help us all at all. Brand Sr. says, I can't tell you anymore until you agree to pilot the last Lazarus mission. And we also, during their explanation, when Coop explained about how they found the NASA location, he's like, look, you're not going to believe me. You're going to think I'm crazy. But it was, you know, gravity sending me these messages. And we see them all kind of perk up. And it wasn't such a hard sell. And then when we see the wormhole, we realize that at this point, what we believe is that an alien presence has made itself known and is attempting to help the human race escape their, you know, sort of death planet, as you will. So, of course, Coop agrees to do it. And we hear about plans A and plan B. Plan A is Coop and his crew finding one of those planets able to sustain life. And back on Earth, Dr. Brand Sr. reconciling gravity with quantum mechanics. And what Brand is saying, that if they discover the secret of gravity, they can lift in massive structures, they can lift most of the world's inhabitants off of Earth by using these sort of anti-gravity technology. And we see that we're told that Brand Sr. has been working on these equations his whole life. We're told that he's very close to solving them. And the, you know, what we get is that he's attempting to reconcile the four forces into one, which is a real thing that's happening in physics right now. String theory was one attempt to do so. There are several other theories, but the four forces of the known universe, the electroweak force, they call electromagnetic force, the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, and gravity. The standard model currently in physics has reconciled the electromagnetism with the weak nuclear force and the strong nuclear force. These are all forces that are can be explained and predicted via equations. However, Einstein is the one who really went to bat for gravity. In Einstein's theories of general and special relativity, they break down at the quantum level, and quantum level mathematics cannot scale up to galaxy level equations of Einstein's. So, to this day, you know, physics is still searching for a unifying theory that unifies all these forces and can explain them all. And so, that there's a little bit of realism in this film, and that should we possibly come to understand gravity in a way that we understand, you know, the quantum world, there is theoretically possible that we may be able to create gravity or control it. And this is the idea of the film, that once these forces are reconciled, we could literally float huge vessels full of people and food and technology off of the Earth and send them where we will through the wormhole if we wanted to. And so this is the deal. Plan B is if they do not solve the gravity problem and they do not unify the forces, they're going to bring hundreds and hundreds of different species, different races and creeds of human beings, fertilized eggs. Because they talk about the realistic problem of inbreeding. If you were going to start a new civilization and you only had like six people, you know, how are you going to avoid the problems of inbreeding and, you know, genetic diversity? And so their solution is to, you know, bring fertilized eggs from a variety of human beings. And then these eggs would be implanted in vitro and women would be surrogates and they could give birth to a variety of human beings. And then at some point when the population was large enough, it could continue on its own to crossbreed and so on and so forth. It's a really cool notion, a really neat idea. I'm sure it's been thought about in many circles if this was actually going to happen. So very cool. Of course, Coop is all about Plan A because, you know, he wants to save his family. But he does agree to pilot the mission. So now this little bit of an arc we get is the Coop's departure and the devastating effect it's having on Murph. His son Tom seems to not give a crap. His father seems to be nonplussed. It's all about Murph and the tears and the crying. She tells him that she deciphered a word in the library, one word, stay, and that she should listen to it. But again, this girl is not a very good actor, and she's very histrionic in a way that's not very cinematic to me, and the scenes are just very unreal. So now Coop explains about time dilation, you know, unfortunately, to depress her further. And we get the very real discussion of relativity, and that at the speeds he's traveling, she's going to be a lot older. And when he returns to Earth, he may very well be the same age. And this, of course, shatters her. She's just angry with him, as a child would be at that age, and is inconsolable. He gives her a watch and sort of says, you know, you hold on to your watch, I'll hold on to mine, and when I get back, we'll compare them to see how much time has, you know, elapsed. She's inconsolable, but he has to leave, and, you know, the soundtrack is queuing up, and he's like, don't leave it like this, Murph. I got to fix this before I go. And, you know, of course, he finally leaves and speeds away in the truck. And just as he's speeding away, she runs out of the house crying, daddy, daddy, daddy. And, you know, we get the unreconciled last moments between father and daughter, which will drive most of the rest of the plot of the film. So now we're into space. We cut to the liftoff of the Lazarus rocket. Now we're into some amazing visuals. And, you know, right from the Apollo mission camera playbook. Beautiful, beautiful visuals of the different stages of the rocket booster falling away. We are introduced a little bit more to TARS, the AI, and TARS has humor and honesty settings, which is very clever. So they went for the opposite of HAL. They went with a robot with a sense of humor, and there's a really funny joke where the robot makes while they're lifting off. He's like, oh, if this doesn't work out, I'll have more slaves for my robot civilization. And I think Nolan did it too much off the cuff, because I don't think the full impact of how funny it is comes through in the film. It might just be me, but I think it's a very clever and very smart move, because where else do you do with AI? You know, what do you make them these days? And to make an AI constantly joking, I think very clever move, and I really like it. we see them dock with Maincraft. So the Lazarus rocket is lifting them into orbit, where they're going to dock with a ship called the Endurance, which is the craft that will take them to and through the wormhole with, I'm assuming, the more powerful drive for the flight to Saturn. And we get a sense that the Saturn trip is going to take about 2 years. And that's about right with present technology as well. It would take about that long to get to Saturn, about 18 months to Jupiter and another 6 months to Saturn. And very Kubrickian in matching spins, so the docking collars will mate. And we get a very detailed look at how the ships dock, and we're going to, that will be visually checked for later in the film when it happens again. So we've already seen it, and we're kind of used to it. Beautiful shots of the Earth and of the crew opening up the ship. There's a second AI on board Endeavour called Case. And the camera work on all of the movements, the camera work seems to be like slapped on the exterior of these ships, and it very much feels like actual shots that I've seen, documentary footage of the space shuttle and of the International Space Station about, some of how these camera angles are done up in orbit, and it's really beautiful. What's wonderful, Nolan, as well, is that he often cuts to silence when we're exterior, and when he's inside the ship, we hear the engines and we hear other things, but for the most part, he keeps to the Kubrickian legacy of trying to show the realities of when you're shooting a ship in the exterior of space. It's silent as the grave. There's nothing there to conduct sound. It's a perfect vacuum, and so you hear nothing. It really is a very effective technique, because when we cut to back to the ship, we hear the sounds of the ship rumbling and the thrusters and the voices, and then we cut to space. Oh, it's beautifully serene, and just a very nice transition when it happens. I really, really appreciated it very much. We get Dr. Brand Sr. reciting Dylan Thomas, "Do not go gentle into this good night," which would be recited ad nauseum, and you'll be sick of it by the time the movie's over. But, it is the sort of theme of the film in poetry, as it were. There are two other members of the crew besides Brand Jr. We have Wes Bentley is a character, and then we have another actor playing a fourth astronaut. So there are four of them on this journey. So they start the centrifuge on the ship, which creates artificial gravity. Still very realistic. We get the hibernation units, and when they hibernate, they go under a liquid. Kind of cool the way they set them up. They look very functional rather than sci-fi slick, as it were. We get some indication that the three astronauts they're going to find, Dr. Edmonds' name is brought up. We get very deliberate shots of Anne Hathaway, and we intimate a little bit that there's something between them, probably some emotional connection. So they all bed down. Cooper, of course, is last, and he leaves a video message for his family. And then we cut to Earth. Dr. Brandt Sr. arrives at the Cooper farm. We're set up with the ability for each side to send messages to each other. The Coopers can record messages, and they'll get sent through the wormhole, and they will be received at the other end. But somehow, we're told that signals from the other end of the wormhole don't make it back through, so no communication could be possible. It's a little confusing, because why are they going to these worlds? I don't know. It goes by so fast that I kind of miss the, is there two-way communication or not? Maybe they don't know that there's not two-way communication, but how would they know to go back? Anyway. We're set up with they can receive messages from Earth, but cannot transmit. So now we are out at Saturn. It's the beginning of some really, really deeply beautiful images that Nolan has given us. Some wonderful piano music, kind of very classical inspired, very quiet. And the Endeavour is transiting Saturn. And what I really love that he does here is and this happens in other parts of the movie as well, he really gives you the sense of scope in that the Endeavour is very small when it comes to how it's depicted against Saturn and against the wormholes. Tiny little ship in the vastness of the galaxy and the solar system. So it's really amazing. Very Kubrick-inspired, but I don't think you can do space shots of any kind without taking a page from Kubrick, who was the best at it. Before they go into the wormhole, Coop gets a message from his son via video. Son's not too happy with him. Not really sure why he's even leaving the message, but leaves it, and no Murph, of course. So then they transit the wormhole, and they do the wormhole kind of hardcore science, where it's a sphere, not a hole. And I think this is from sort of Thorne's calculations. I love that it's in the movie, and I love how they very easily describe it as one of the astronauts takes a piece of paper, folds it in on itself, puts a pencil through it, you know, but a hole in a three-dimensional space is actually a sphere, and it's fantastic. And it's great how they move into it. It's kind of, you know, one of Nolan's versions of the Stargate, as it were. It's a really beautiful sequence. There's this wonderful emergence, and the ship starts to really speed up, and the effects at this point, when you're looking out of the ship, are just gorgeous. You know, I would imagine that you're lucky enough to see this section. I saw this film regular 35 millimeter screening, but if you had seen this sequence in IMAX, it must have been just awe-inspiring and really beautiful. When they're about three quarters of the way through their transit, there's some odd distortion that happens in the cabin. Brandt thinks that she shook hands with an alien. It's just an odd moment. And of course, later on, that's a little seed that will bear fruit. So they exit the wormhole and they're in this new solar system. There's a load of data that's been communicated back from Miller, Mann, and Edmondson, who are the three explorers. And so they find out a little bit about the worlds that they explored. Basically, Wes Bentley tells us kind of the status of things. Edmonds' beacon had gone dark. But Mann and Miller both were broadcasting thumbs up, meaning that their worlds were viable for human life. And so they have to kind of choose, you know, where they're going to go next. So now we get an initial complication. And they use some science here, which is kind of cool. Miller's world orbits very close to the black hole, which lies in the center of the system called Gargantua. You know, as you get closer to any intense gravity, time moves for the person in that gravity much slower than those not in that gravity. And so, in a sense, you know, you speed through time as the rest of the world speeds by you. They set up this condition that every hour they spend on Miller's world, 7 years would pass back on Earth. And at a certain distance in orbit, the ship that anyone who stayed behind on would be 7 years an hour. Very cool. Cooper, in one of his many instances where, you know, the engineer from the farm, you know, turns out to be quite a capable astrophysicist once he gets going, he theorizes that if they keep the Endeavor back and use their shuttle to go down, they'll lose a lot less time than if they had the Endeavor actually orbiting the world directly, and they would all lose time. However, they have to leave one of the astronauts behind, Romilly. Supposedly, you know, it's going to be only a couple of years because they're going to be in and out really quickly, maybe 20 minutes down, get Miller's data and get out or get her. Wes Bentley and Cooper, Brandt and Case, one of the AI robots, detaches from the Endeavor and they head down, leaving Romilly behind. So again, you know, we're back in space travel and Nolan does the wonderful silence and sound shifts, really amazing. And the black hole is incredible. You've never seen a black hole looking like this. This is what has been theorized using Kip Thorne's equations, and they actually use it. They use Thorne's equations to help program some of the special effects computations to come up with this thing. And it's amazing looking, really, really incredible. It's very large in the screen too. So, you know, you never get a sense of seeing a black hole from a distance, small in the screen. It's always this massive thing that barely fits in the screen. And I think it's intentional and really clever on Nolan's part. There's something, I don't know, there's something odd here where they're going to leave Romilly alone for 2 years while they go down and retrieve this data. And I guess they have to do it, but I don't know. I mean, you know, it struck me that, you know, leaving a human being alone for any period of time and complete isolation would damage them emotionally and mentally. And it's not really dealt with here because they need to do other things to make the plot work. But I don't know. There was something very cavalier about them just saying, all right, well, we'll be going down for like 15 minutes and we'll see you in 2 years. I don't know. It was too pat, I guess. It was too easy. And Romilly, they didn't really explore Romilly's reaction to it or what it was going to be like. You know, so everyone assumes it's going to be okay. So I just found that a little weird. So because Coop wants to get down fast, you know, he takes control of the ship manually. And the Wes Bentley character is like, damn it, Cooper, you know, what are you doing? I know what I'm doing, you know. And Coop's character, of course, you know, I guess using aero braking gets the ship down much faster. But it's, you know, very dangerous. And I don't know, it felt kind of absurd to me. And they land in this very shallow sea. We see far in the distance what looks like mountains. And we're not really sure yet what is what here. And the soundtrack cue contains kind of a clockwork-like sound, a ticking sound in it, which reminding us, you know, every minute that's passing here, you know, enormous amounts of time are passing back on the ship. So they find Miller's beacon, and the ship has been ripped apart. There's nothing remaining, but some of her, there's some brief computer data banks containing some data about the world. And then what we thought was mountains are actually these gargantuan tidal waves, massive in size. I mean, they're really cool. I mean, they are so tall. And the camera has to takes a moment to track up them to give you the sense of, you know, massive scale. And then one's heading right for them, so we have a clock ticking. Now we have this whole situation where Brand's like, I got to get Miller's data. Cooper's like, you don't have enough time. She goes to get the data, but she gets stuck. And the robot case has to kind of, it turns into kind of a spoked wheel, which is very cool. It has to rescue her because she you know, she's stuck behind this detritus. Doyle, the Wes Bentley character, just be sitting there waiting. And basically he's, kill me now because you don't need me for the rest of the movie sticker on him. And he's just waiting around looking at waves a lot. It just is kind of odd. And I thought it was kind of a weird setup that they needed to kill him. But his death really made no sense. His presence there made no sense, nor did his death. He was just kind of a third wheel who died for no real reason. I know, it was weird. But we get the ship riding the wave, and it rides all the way up the front of it and back down the crest. And it, the engines get wet. Brand does make it back in time, but Doyle is killed. And then now they have to wait for the engines to dry out. What they're talking about also is that the twist here is that because from the planet's time perspective, Miller had only just landed like hours ago. And so she had kind of just died, which is really kind of cool. And then Cooper is furious at her, like, how could you take such risks? Meanwhile, you know, he almost destroyed the freaking spaceship, you know, coming down there in his reckless way. And, you know, he has the temerity to yell at her. None of it works or makes any sense. You know, it's just Coop gets to be indignant. So Cooper's like, we lost time. We lost decades now because they have to wait for the engines to dry out, for them to start. Cooper's like, how can we reverse time? How can we fix this? You know, Johnny Engineer. Brand is like, the only thing that can move through time is gravity, which is setting up, you know, the end of the film. Coop schools Brandt about being a parent, and the most important thing in the world is making them feel safe, blah, 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 which, I don't know, just banal to me. Maybe it's true, but I don't care in this moment for whatever reason. Coop's just yelling at everybody all the time. He's telling everybody what to do. He's telling everyone what their mistakes are and why they're not thinking about things correctly. Like, he's just the perfect hero, you know? Like, he never does anything wrong. There's not a blemish on him. Nobody blames him for leaving his daughter back on Earth. We all know he did it for altruistic reasons, you know? And, you know, whenever he goes off on one of these things, I just feel like it's very artificial. I don't feel it, as I should. I don't know. It's just, it's always very odd to me. But it does begin, and to my mind, this is where the movie, for my personal taste, does not work, because what's happening here is that Nolan is trying to bring in this sort of ideas of family and human relationships with these cosmic forces that we see, you know, the black hole and the incredible forces of time. And now he's trying to bring in like love and gravity as these mitigating forces that can, you know, transcend the universe. And to me, it almost becomes more supernatural as the film goes on than anything about science, where he's kind of trying to hoodwink us with all this wonderful science and this wonderful theories that he's expounding out in the film. But it just seems very pat, like, I love my family and I will do anything to save them, and how important that is. And, you know, I don't doubt, in the real world, I don't doubt that. But in this movie, it just, it sounds very banal, and I don't know, I don't buy it. And I, at this moment, I felt like Kubrick knew already what Nolan still struggles with, to accept that in the face of, you know, these cosmic forces, that human relationships pale to almost insignificance. Not to us who are here, but when you're out in the universe and you're in the universe's backyard, that it does kind of obliterate these ties in certain ways. And, you know, Nolan doesn't want it. He doesn't want to have it that way. Nolan wants those feelings and these relationships to transcend the universe. And I feel like he's going backwards, where Kubrick was actually going forwards towards a new unknowing kind of evolution that may allow us to grow and perhaps connect to each other in ways we've never imagined, but it has to be on the universe's dime, as it were. And I think Kubrick kind of understands that yes, these forces can happen, they can't transcend. We kind of have to transcend and bring them with us in some way. So I don't know. I just feel like Kubrick is just so knowing and wise. And I feel like Nolan's kind of a, you know, kind of like a kid here. And he wants his cake and he wants to eat it too. Anywho, another wave comes. It's another great special effect, of course. But Coop comes up with some hot wiring kind of way to start the engines early. And he does it in a moment of daring do and drama. The ship, you know, crests the wave and finally comes back. They enter back into the Endurance. And 23 years have passed on Earth. And for Romilly, who's there. And again, Romilly, to me, should have been a bubbling idiot or in cryosleep. And again, you know, he's a non-character really. But, you know, my God, this man has survived 23 years alone. We do hear that he went down into hypersleep for some of it, right? But I don't know. It's just they treat it with, it's like, 23 years, Romilly, what's been going on? Oh, you guys have got some messages. Okay, great, thanks. And we're done with Romilly, and now we're back into Coop and his problems. And there's so many times in this movie where I just, I don't know, I felt very detached, like really like a spectator. And again, however, now we quickly get into what I think is one of the ways the movie worked really well, the real emotional core of this film, where now we're using time and using the forces of the universe to create this dramatic moment where he's seeing his grown children and their lives as they grow. Seeing 23 years of his son growing up and having children, his father dying. McConaughey is an amazing actor, and so he really sells it. He's weeping through half of it, and the soundtrack cues are great. They're not too intense, you know, so they don't overplay it. And it's a beautiful moment. I mean, I think one of the most beautiful moments in the film is when he's here watching his family and just weeping for the time lost and for the joy and that their lives are kind of playing out while he's halfway across the universe. And this is McConaughey's moment to me in this film. He is amazing. And finally, near the end, he gets one message from an adult Murph, and she's still angry at her father, and she's still pissed off at him. And, you know, her anger to me, while very human, is beginning to make less and less sense in this film. She is an incredibly bright person. She's a scientist. She knows what's going on about the Earth. She knows that what the decision that he made and that she would be, that the, you know, the end result of her character is this continual lack of understanding about her father's choice, and that, you know, she has no life, that she, nothing really much happens to her. She's just this constantly embittered woman that daddy left me when I was a girl, you know, and I've never forgiven him. And I don't like it. I don't like that character being reduced to such a single stereotype that this, you know, that I never got over my dad leaving when I was a kid. Never, you know, never got over it. I still am angry at him. I still don't understand. And I feel like the screenwriters need her to be this way in order to play on our emotions and to play on Coop's and to give Coop that, you know, that incredible urge to like make it right with Murph and to, for her to understand that I never left you. I was with you the whole time. I was trying to save you every minute. I wanted to get back, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, here's this character who's just like, my daddy left me while I was a daughter, and I never forgave him. I'm bitter about it. And I don't know. I thought it was kind of a short shrift to that character. So I didn't really appeal to me. So then we actually cut back to Murph back at NASA. She's working there now as an adult scientist and working with Dr. Brand, senior, on his computations. And she's starting to get a sense that something's amiss with his work. So then we cut right back to, you know, the new planet system, and Coop and Romilly and Brandt and Case and Tars have to make these decisions. Now, there's a lot less fuel because they spend a lot more time on the planet. So they have to pick to go to whether to go to this guy Edmonds' planet or Mann's planet. Now, Mann's is closer. Brand is the planetologist here, and she wants to go to Edmonds, and Cooper suspects that she and Edmonds have a thing and that she's letting her personal feelings come between her and the mission, which I kind of feel like is the pot calling the kettle black for this whole movie. And there's this kind of banal discussion where Brand is now like, maybe love is something we don't understand. And this is, to me, this is Nolan's thesis for the movie. Maybe love is like a force in the universe and it does exist and we can't understand it. And I make decisions based on love. Maybe they are real. Maybe I should listen to my heart. And there's a wisdom there that we don't get. And like, of course, that's a true, real thing in life, right? No doubt about it. But the way they have Brand do it makes her, the two of the scientists on board are like, oh, you know, the lovey-dovey girl wants to go see her boyfriend and she's not being rational, you know? And when Coop finally does it, the whole movie's behind him, right, to do it. But when Bran does it, like, they kind of chastise her. And I don't like it. I don't like what they do here. Even though, you know, the whole thesis about love is fantastic. If in another movie, I think. I don't know. They give these ideas about, why do I love people who have died? Why do I love this man Edmondson who I haven't seen in so many years? Like, it's kind of absurd reasons, and, you know, best to keep it more in the mystery realm than to come out with these kind of banal reasons of, like, you know, why people are obsessed with other people. It's not necessarily love, you know what I mean? I think we've all lived long enough on this planet to know that love is not involved in a lot of these obsessional feelings we have about other people. It's quite the opposite, frankly. So, again, another false note. And frankly, you know, he's done all these risky maneuvers with the ship to get down there on time, because he doesn't want a lot of time to pass so he can get home to his family. And now he's accusing Brand of doing something out of love, which it doesn't ring true to me. We cut to back on Earth. Tom is burning some crops. I guess blight is now attacking corn, so the Earth is in real trouble. Tom lives at the Cooper house, and Murphy's over for dinner. Again, she's still screwed up about her dad's, you know, leaving. Then we cut to her visiting Brand in the hospital, who's dying. Brand now admits to her that he lied in terms of, you know, the equations. Plan A was never supposed to work. He created the fiction of the being close in his equations to solving the uniting the four forces, but it was all a fiction. And basically, what he did was kind of keep the lie alive to give people hope when he knew there wasn't ever any for Plan A. So Murph transmits a message to Brand, you know, ostensibly to tell her that your father has died, and she tags it with, "Did you know? Did he tell you that it was all a lie? It's all a sham." And actually, there's a chilling moment here when we see the message playing on the video screen. Bran and Cooper, with Tars, I believe, have already left to go down to Man's planet, because they're at his planet at this point. It's actually a chilling scene, because you think, are they going to miss this? You know, so very cool, very cool. And then we cut to Dr. Man's planet, and it's a great scene here where they're flying in what looks like clouds, but the ship kind of bumps into one, and we realize that the cloud formations are frozen. It's beautiful. Very impressive and very unexpected. I was really impressed with that. They land, and the planet looks like kind of a big glacier. It's like all frozen over. And they come upon this small ship, which is Man's ship. He's in cryosleep. He's revived, and it's Matt Damon as Dr. Man. And there's a nice, really good scene when he wakes up and sees Coop, and he just starts crying, and Coop holds him, and they kind of just hang there for a minute, and he lets it out, you know. It's a really good scene. Damon's wake-up monologue is really good, talking about how, you know, may you never, something upon the arms of, may you never know how amazing it is to see a human face the way I see yours, and, you know, being alone for all the years that he's been alone. So he takes him on a basically walking trip, kind of his voiceover, and we hear the specs on the world, and he tells them that, you know, they're only on the frozen upper cloud layer, but then on the surface of the planet, it's breathable air, it's beautiful, you know, tropical almost. And we see in his little habitat, there's a dissembled robot named Kip, K-I-P-P. I'm, you know, assuming a little shout out to Kip Thorne, a scientist and a co-creator of the story. So Case, back on Endeavor, relays now Murph's video message through Tars, which makes the kind of the sadness of that scene that just happened kind of meaningless, because you thought, wow, they're never gonna know it was meaningless until they find out from Man. But I don't know, it was just weird, because I think Man knew as well. That's somewhat vague, but we watch Brant go over to the video screen, she watches it, and then at some crucial moment, Cooper comes over, and, you know, the jig is up, basically. The last ending scene of Murph is, you know, she's crying, and, did you leave us here, Dad? Did you know you were never coming back? And she's just angry with him, and it's so melodramatic. Did you leave us here to die? I just have to know, you know? I just found it very melodramatic and very unbelievable, and only to jack up the audience, give us some emotions to play with, and to jack up Cooper's character. And Matt, you know, he's given the motivation now to transcend space and time to be with this woman. Man then confirms the story, which I feel like is a missed moment in the script, because to find out from Man would have been chilling, but to find out the way they found out, but they needed Murph to jack up Cooper, so he's at wit's end, wanting to get home. And at that moment, actually, he decides that he's going to leave Dr. Brent there with Man, but he's going back. He's got to go back and see his daughter, and none of it makes any sense to me. He's going to tell them all that You know, I don't know why the hell he's going back, but it's absurd in that he berates Brandt and these people for these emotions and blah, blah, blah. Now he's heading back, you know, because his daughter, you know, he's got to go back millions of miles to tell his daughter that he's sorry. It's like, dude, get over it, you know. She'll live or she won't. I don't know. Don't like it. So now Coop gets into problem-solving mode. All right, damn it. How do we solve gravity, damn it? How do we reconcile relativity with quantum mechanics? You know, Coop wants to break out the calculator and the number two pencils and shoot off some rockets. And when I watch this, I'm with Mann and Brand. And I think Coop's just kind of like, you know, doing his movie star bit and this hero, like, the hero never accepts defeat. He keeps going until he transcends space and time and wins the day. And when you've brought me along and set me up with such an enormous amount of science, such care, and talking about relativity and how you're filming the ships, now you're going into this basically ghost, right? Basically David Zucker's ghost, Jerry Zucker's ghost, as it were, which I'll get more into in a little bit. I'm lost, man, and I think that you're trying to have all the marbles and you're willing to discard things when you want them and then bring them back when it suits you. And when I see a filmmaker kind of playing fast and loose with the rules that they've set down in this universe, I'm toast. We get this kind of bullshit line about a gentle singularity. Such things as gentle singularity. You know, first we get all this hardcore notion about what a singularity is and what it's not and what you can't know from it. And no, you know what? No, this one's a gentle singularity. And if we skim just close enough, we can send TARS down there to skim the singularity and transmit the data. And we just got to get some parts from Kip to kind of make this work. And dropping the notion that as he gets close to the black hole, time for Kip will slow down to just about infinity. If you're touching an event horizon or you're right there, it would take like thousands, if not millions of years for any signal that Kip is going to send back to reach Coop. So, but all of this is discarded because it's not necessary for the plot. The plot needs to wrap up. We need to get moving here. So Mann takes Cooper now for this walkabout to sort of scout around for good sites for these colony modules, which they're dropping now from the Endeavor. Now, Mann's given us this whole monologue, which is preparing us for the climax of the movie. And he's talking about, you know, why is it at the moment of death? It's scientifically proven, which is also an absurd thing, that, you know, we see the faces of our children because in that moment, the mind makes one last incredible leap to reunite with its children, right? And of course, this is a complete setup of what's going to happen to Coop. So, you know, now we're in like this this Lifetime movie about the supernatural Lifetime movie about parents and children. I don't know what movie we're in at this point. But we do cut back to Earth to get the clock ticking that Earth is in trouble. We're on the farm with Murph, Tom again, and, you know, they want to take the children to the doctor because they have lung problems. But I guess, you know, Tom's kind of a dumb farm hick, which we were kind of intimated to believe, and that he doesn't hold with any of that science crap. And they don't believe about any of it having this kind of rust lung or whatever it is that they have. Then we cut back to Mann's planet, and Mann actually pushes Cooper down what would be his death, but he kind of holds on. And what he tells him is that he's lied and that there is no garden underneath. There's just more frozen rock. The planet cannot sustain life, but that he faked the data because he wanted to see another human being. Now, this makes sense to me, and I like this, and that, you know, this is where his humanity is, like, he lied about the science. And how many times has that happened that we've, this past 10 years, that we've heard about people faking theses and faking results, you know, because of their emotional failings and wanting to become famous or needing the approval of their peers, right? I mean, that really rung true to me. I was, in a sense, I think Mann is the most developed character, other than his, you know, on-the-nose monologues that he has to deliver for the story. He's the most believable character to me, in that his loneliness for another human face, he wasn't willing to die when he got to that planet. And that's an incredible notion, too, that I was thinking about when I watched this, that the minute Mann touched down on this planet, he knew that it couldn't support life. It was a death sentence for him. That was it. He signed on for it, yes, but now the reality is that, you know, a guy in his 30s or early 40s, he's consigned to live the rest of his life alone with a robot. on this planet. I mean, very intense. And I understand now him doing whatever he could possibly do to get back aboard the Endeavor. I feel like he could have just asked Coop at that point, saying, look, why don't we all forget about this whole human race thing? We all realize none of us want to really do it. Let's just get back in the ship and go home. You know, like, I think Coop would have let him. I don't know. It might have been a more interesting drama, the chances of them coming back. But I'm talking about a movie in my head now and not this movie. So anyway, back on Earth, we get Murph's anger again. Daddy left us here to die. Okay, we get it. You know, check. Oh, my God. You know, Coop's got to reunite with his daughter or she'll die. Like, you know, forget about that. The planet's going to die. Whatever. Back on the planet, man and Coop are now fighting because Coop didn't go all the way down. And so they're scrabbling around and man headbutts Cooper, cracking his helmet. And now he leaves him. But Coop finds the long-range sensor that man had ripped off his helmet. It's actually a communication device. He activates it and he communicates with Brand, telling them what the story is. Also telling her that, you know, he needs help. So now we get these parallel narratives that are going to run through to the end of the movie. Murph has had this moment of epiphany where she's like, the answer to gravity lies in the library at my house. And in order to get her brother out, she lights his crops on fire. So he leaves the house and she runs up into the library and now she's there. Now, Brand takes one of the landers and saves Cooper from asphyxiation. Now, Romilly is back at man's little habitat, and he's accessing the information inside Kip, and he realizes that what man had told Cooper, that you know, man's data is all wrong, that the planet cannot support life. But man had jury-rigged it, and it explodes, killing Romilly. But Tars, who was in there, survives. I guess he's military-grade, made of sterner stuff. Man is able to get to the main dropship and heads back up towards Endeavor. And Cooper and Brandt are sort of following hard upon his heels. But so now we get this long sequence. Tars disabled the auto-docking sequence of the ship, which we saw earlier in the film when they had a dock. This very elaborate sequence. So man has to manually dock the ship. So it's a very lengthy sequence. I think he was getting at some Kubrickian stuff here, but it's just a long sequence where you see man trying to dock the ship, and we're seeing that he's not done it properly, and that they keep trying to contact him, you know, please don't open the airlock because you're not docked properly, you'll blow the ship up. And man, of course, does, and he explodes. And that part of the Endeavor rips away, and it sends the Endeavor spinning around incredibly rapidly. But of course, you know, Coop steps up, and he's like, damn it, I'm going to dock it anyway. As the Endeavor is heading down towards the planet, lower and lower, Coop matches spin with it, you know, and because he's like, he can take high Gs because he's a big man. Very big Hollywood climax moment here. He docks with the ship, and they stop it and get it back up out of orbit. So at this point, now they're heading into Gargantua's pull, and they have to make some decisions. And there's some great shots of the shredded parts of the ship. Like, it looks definitely CGI, but it looks really great. Edmund's planet now is their only hope. And what they're going to do is use the combined forces of all the landers and the Endeavor and slingshot around Gargantua and get to Edmund's planet. So, you know, using a little bit of astrophysics here, which is kind of cool. And during that moment, they're going to send Tars down to slip down to graze the event horizon and send back data in contravention of, you know, all known physics, but whatever. Then we get really a lot of good shots of Gargantua and the smallness of the Endeavor up against Gargantua. It's so beautiful. I mean, the black hole is just, I think I could have watched an hour of just the black hole. It's so beautiful to behold and to think about what it means, you know. So then we have one last twist. Coop lied to Brandt, and there's not only Tars, but him as well, have to detach from the ship. There's too much weight. With Coop on the ship, supposedly the extra 200 pounds, they won't have enough thrust to get the Endeavor to Edmund's planet. And so Coop, in his big sacrifice moment, you know, heads down towards the black hole, and Brandt's like, no, no, Coop. So now we have sort of the Kubrick Stargate sequence, and Tars and Coop both falling through the black hole, and through, you know, this is the mystery part where nothing happens to them. They just kind of go, Coop kind of goes through this strange little Stargate moment, which doesn't last very long. We get the kind of readouts in his helmet like we got for Bowman. We're cutting back to Earth. Tom's putting out the fire. Murph's in the library like, where are you, Dad? Where are you, Dad? Right? And Coop blows the ejection seat in, blows out into space now, and he's kind of alone floating somewhere. Then he enters what's represented here as, five-dimensional space represented in a three-dimensional universe. And it's basically like this, you know, weird kind of visually stacked library. And Coop's able to kind of move around, and each, you know, each library that he comes to is in a different time, but they're all laid out kind of linearly, which is clever. But so he's behind the wall here, and we realize in this moment that he was the ghost from the beginning of the movie. He was the one knocking the books off. It's him. He's surrounded by libraries on all sides, and he starts to figure out that if he just finds the right library, he gets certain periods of time. We see earlier periods of the movie with him in it and his daughter. In this moment, I realize that what Nolan was trying to do was take the 2001 moment of man evolving, but being kept in, you know, 2001, he's in this, like, you know, 17th century drawing room for the rest of his life until he dies. And when he dies, then he is transmuted into the Star Child. But here, you know, this is Coop's moment where he's brought here by them. We don't know who them is yet. In an effort to, you know, become part of the salvation of his own people. McConaughey's great here. And I have to say that as much as I think his character is kind of a joke, there are times here and in the early part when he's watching, you know, the videos of his children growing up, when, man, he's very powerful and sells it. You know, his emotionality is very strong, and I'm with him, strangely enough. I feel the tug here when he's, you know, longing for his child, which I'm supposed to, right? Then we have adult Murph in the library. Somehow she makes this incredible leap of faith that Dad was the ghost. Who the hell knows why she gets here, but she does. Then Coop hears Tars. Tars is also in this five-dimensional space. You know, first we're given the information in the movie that Coop is here because love brought him here, and love and gravity are somehow connected, and love brought him to. So how Tars is still there, you know. To me, this is Ghost. This is Ghost. Patrick Swayze shows up and, like, saves Demi Moore at the end. I mean, that's what I feel like this is. Like, you know, he's suddenly stuck a kind of a melodramatic ghost story into this sci-fi epic, mashed them together, and it just feels very off. So Tars has the quantum data from the singularity that will solve the equations of gravity, and all Coop has to do is figure out how to transmit it to his daughter. Coop thinks at first that he's got to do it to his daughter in the past so she has time to interpret the equations, but somehow Tars knows what to do, and he says, I don't think they brought us here to change the past, Coop. And Cooper says that, no, we brought ourselves here, and I brought myself here. And why did Tars bring himself there? I have no idea. You know, using the power inside of the singularity, which gave his love a dimension beyond space and time to reach back to his daughter. So anyway, he coordinates this information in what he calls binary. Then we hear something that they chose her to save the world. Really? Okay. And then Coop says that this is love brought him here. It's quantifiable. It is a force. Brandt was right. Then Murph's about to leave the library, and she sees the second hand on her watch move in Morse, because now binary or Morse, I don't remember, but he's going to transmit these complex equations by using the gravity to move the hand in her watch. Murph realizes that it's him. It's Daddy. Even she hugs Tom, who somehow believes all this hogwash. And then she sits upstairs for hours and just translates all the data. Now we have the kind of math montage. She's running, screaming Eureka, and throwing papers into the air. She solved gravity. Amazing. Then we get from McConaughey that they are us, future humanity. And future humanity, I guess, needs this moment to work out. I'm lost. I can't even narrate this. And now the library tesseract, as it's called, collapses because his work is done. He's now floating out somewhere near Saturn. And we realize he's the one who shook Brand's hand when they had that weird spatial moment. They leave him just floating outside the orbit of Saturn. And then we cut to a hospital bed. So we realize he's in the, you know, fairly far future, I guess. He walks out, and it's kind of cool. He's in this cylindrical structure, and they're playing baseball, but it's actually in a structure, so we see the sides of it going right up. And kind of cool. It's Cooper Station ordering Saturn. Find out that Murph is still very much alive, although she's very old, and she's on her way there from Earth. And obviously, he's having solved gravity, you know, that they were able to lift off all these people from Earth because she solved gravity. We walk by some shuttlecraft-looking ships, and we visually check them. which we'll come back to them very soon. So then he's sitting, he goes back to, there's a recreation of the farmhouse on Cooper Station, and he's sitting there drinking a beer. It's kind of a museum, and he kind of hangs out there, reactivates Tars, and he's sitting on the porch drinking a beer, and Tars is sitting next to him. He reunites with his daughter. She's in bed surrounded by this huge extended family that she has. He walks in. I always knew it was you, blah, blah, blah. They spend like 2 minutes together, and then she's like, go get Brand, you know. That I've hated you for years. Then I knew it was you. This is great, but go get laid, kid. I don't know. And then I feel like this is my axe grinding, but I feel like we're undermining her whole character. People thought it was me doing it, but it was you, Dad. It was always you. You know, what I guess desperate father always wants to hear that he's done right by his daughter, right? That he gets the satisfaction late in life that it was all because of you, Dad. You know, you're the one who's made my life, blah, blah, blah. Okay, Nolan, thanks, you know. He leaves, he takes a shuttle, goes back through the wormhole, basically is on his way to, you know, go save Brand. And we see these last shots of Brand, who's kind of started her own colony. And I guess, you know, she could possibly impregnate herself with these embryos and she could kind of do it on her own. And we don't know whether Coop's going to join her there and start the colony or bring her back. It's very ambivalent. And that's it. We're out. That ends Interstellar. So, you know, just to recap a little bit, I really enjoy Nolan's films. I mean, I've enjoyed, I appreciated Following. I loved Memento. I thought Insomnia kind of left me cold. I was on board for Batman Begins, The Prestige, The Dark Knight, Inception, Dark Knight Returns. I love his movies. You know, I'm a big fan. I think this one failed. I think it was a failure. I think it was him trying to take what he probably saw as maybe a failure of what science fiction movies are. Sometimes, you know, science fiction movies with cosmic themes can be a little sterile. And I think he thought this was going to be his way to meld themes of the deepest emotional needs of a human being, which is the love for family, with, you know, these cosmic forces. I don't think it works. I really think that he starts out with Coop and being this Johnny Science, and it's all about science, and he's sticking close to the science, and the science causes this, and it's great, you know? And then the latter half of the movie breaks down because now the ghost story has to come back in, which it literally is, and it all becomes about, you know, love is an actual force in the universe, and it's great, and I'm not poo-pooing that at all in any way. The way it's done in this movie where they start to discard science and they start to get into really crazy stuff that I think is shot. I don't think Nolan is the visionary that Kubrick was. And I'm not a, you know, I love Kubrick, but I'm not a Kubrick file. I don't love every one of his movies. So I'm not like, I'm not a Kubrick is God guy. But 2001 is one of Kubrick's best films and consequently one of the best films I've ever made. Kubrick got it right. I mean, he got this right. And I think Nolan tried to do similar things, but he didn't have the vision. Kubrick had the vision to let go of his human character in a sense. Nolan has a very linear, very, I don't know, a different vision where he's going to make this a human story to the last. I don't know. I think it becomes very absurd at the end because McConaughey's flipping around this library and it just, it becomes so outlandish. And I don't think I was prepared. I was prepared for more and more hard science and more hard choices. And then something maybe truly transcendent, but not that. You know, I will see probably every movie Nolan makes as long as I live because I think he's great. But for my taste, this one was not one of my faves. I'll just say that. So that ends this episode talking about Interstellar. Hope you enjoyed it. We are scifionscreen.com and I'm on Facebook. You can search for us on any smartphone podcast app and you can subscribe. And as new episodes go up every week, if you subscribe, they automatically download, get us while we're hot, as it were. Appreciate very much everyone listening and hope you really enjoyed it. And I will see you next time.